his way through thick mangrove under the surface. When he thought he was in position, he lifted his head out of the water slowly and looked around in all directions. He quickly realized he'd made a miscalculation. He'd arrived at the shore, and it looked much as it did in the Eagle View image, but there was a problem. The mangrove was so thick on this part of the shoreline, Dom knew he wouldn't be able to get through it without a chainsaw. He took a moment to try and pick another location to come ashore. After a minute, he saw a tiny cove ahead that might have dipped deep enough into the mangrove to allow Dom to fight his way through, so he put the second stage of his regulator back into his mouth and went back under the water. He swam to the middle of the inlet, again to prevent his bubbles from being obvious to anyone on the shore, but as he arrived, he heard the unmistakable sound of a boat's engine. He stopped where he was, hovering 25 feet below the surface, rising and falling slowly as he took breaths from his tank that filled his lungs and made him more buoyant, and then blew them out again. He saw the hull of the boat now, directly overhead and trolling slowly. He put it at about 30 feet. It was hard to discern anything about the type of craft from his view below it, but as he watched for a few moments, he got the impression the objective of those on the boat was some sort of a patrol. They didn't seem to be fishing, because it was moving through the channel, and they certainly weren't hauling cargo or ferrying people, because of their slow speed. Dom worried the boat was somehow tied to the Venezuelan safe house, and he knew if his concerns were valid, getting out of the area in a hurry was going to be even more difficult than he'd imagined. 15 minutes after the trolling boat disappeared, Dom returned to the shore less than 200 yards from the edge of the lawn that encircled the Venezuelan safe house. He ended up infiltrating a little closer to the target than he would have liked, but after seeing how dense the jungle was around here, he decided to chance it, not wanting to risk spending the entire day moving into position. As soon as he was out of the water and into the trees, he took off all his scuba gear, closed his tank to preserve the remaining air, and hid everything under thick ferns that grew below the canopy of crabwood and guarayuba trees. From his pack, he pulled a dark brown shirt and camouflage pants and a pair of black sneakers. Very little of the rain made it through the trees down to him, but he hoped the heavy cloud cover would continue throughout the day to keep him cool. He stuck the M9 pistol into his waistband, slipped the backpack onto his back, and checked his location with his GPS. He added a waypoint to the device's computer, pinpointing the exact location where he stowed his scuba gear, fully expecting to exfil from the target the same way he'd ingressed. Before he began moving toward his intended hide site, he heard the rumbling of a boat again passing through the inlet. He dropped down on his belly and moved behind the ferns, then peeked between them. In front of him, he saw a 30-foot Panamanian police boat with 4 men on board and a 50-caliber machine gun jutting from the bow. From its size and its speed, Dom felt certain this was the vessel he'd swum below earlier. Now it was back. The boat seemed to be on a regular patrol and not hunting for anything in particular, but Dom didn't like the fact that it happened to be cruising around this narrow inlet. He could swim under the patrol boat with no problem if he had to escape, but in case Adara needed to retrieve him from the shore for some reason, he knew the police in the bigger, faster, and much more heavily armed boat could pose a serious problem. Once the patrol boat had moved on up the inlet, Dom turned and left the bank, pushing his way through the thick foliage. He moved purposefully but without rushing, doing his best to keep an eye out for snakes and spiders and other creatures that could ruin his day. This was a typical tropical rainforest. Ferns and flowering plants along the ground, proliferating in the wet air and low light below a triple canopy of oak and guava and sandbox trees. The way forward was arduous, but at least the ground was flat and only moist as opposed to muddy. Dom made good progress and took special care to check his GPS repeatedly to avoid accidentally popping out of the jungle and stumbling into the Venezuelans. It took him 1 hour and 20 minutes to travel 200 yards, but by 9:45 a.m., Dom caught his first glimpse through the rainforest of the back of the big colonial-style Venezuelan safe house. He stopped, lowered himself down to his hands and knees, and found a fair hiding spot at the edge of the tree line. He secreted himself and his gear tight against the trunk of an oak tree, surrounded by viney epiphyte and wild fern, and he slid his brown pack in front of his body to disrupt his outline. Only when he was comfortable that he was secure in his location did he pull out his binoculars and scan the property in front of him. The rain had stopped and the sun had come out, cooking the water in the air and making for oppressive humidity, especially here on the floor of the rainforest. Dom had trouble focusing his optics through the haze, but after some work he saw two big and old black Ford Expeditions parked on a dirt drive and facing away from the main house. Dom knew there was no paved road system on this island, but from Eagle View he'd seen a few crisscrossing dirt tracks running through the jungle. Two men stood at the dock that jutted out into the inlet. Next to them, a pair of white speedboats bobbed in the water. The men wore light khaki shorts and linen shirts, but Dom could see big black Heckler & Koch G3 rifles hanging from their shoulders. Another pair of men strolled the grounds in the distance, and they also wore G3s. Dom felt certain there would be a lot more than four armed guards, but he had only a three-quarters view of the rear of the property. On the far side of the colonial mansion, and only barely in view from his position in the trees to the east, he saw a kennel with large dogs inside. He thought they were German shepherds or Belgian Malinois. Either way, he was certain they were part of the property's defense. His initial scan of the windows of the building had turned up no signs of Ethan Ross, but from the defensive posture of the location, he had a strong suspicion the Venezuelans felt the need to protect something inside the house. He checked in with Adara on the satellite phone, swatted at some bugs crawling up and down his arms, drank some warm water from his canteen, and settled into his hide. He fully expected to be here at least 24 hours, so he tried to make himself as comfortable as possible in his hide site next to the oak tree. 34. The Russian Navy's Admiral Chabanenko was a modern Udaloy II-class anti-submarine warfare destroyer, so the 163-meter-long vessel drew a lot of attention from the locals as it dropped anchor in the harbor at the Pacific Nicaraguan port of San Juan del Sur. The ship had just arrived for a 3-day call, another stop in a friendly nation during its 5-month cruise of the southern Western Hemisphere. The sailors on board the Admiral Chabanenko could barely contain their excitement at the prospect of a liberty call. Even though no one expected much from the sleepy third-world port, the sailors also knew they couldn't be choosy, and a couple of days of booze, women, fresh food, and terra firma, in that order, sounded good to everyone afforded shore leave. Plus, their money would go further here in Nicaragua than it had in Buenos Aires or even Caracas. The rumors of beers costing only 15 Cordobas, about 20 rubles, sounded particularly inviting to the poorly paid Russian sailors, who would spend a minimum of 4 times that amount at a European port of call. An hour before the first of the Admiral Chabanenko crew disembarked for the frivolity ashore, a secure radio call came for the leader of a 6-man unit of Russian naval Spetsnaz on board. The first lieutenant had been packing his weekend bag to go ashore with his men, but instead he ran up to the Marine Operations Center to take the call. As a Spetsnaz commander, the first lieutenant was actually a member of the GRU, Military Intelligence, so he was not completely surprised to learn the voice on the other end of the radio was a GRU captain lieutenant. But when he was transferred to an FSB general in Moscow to be given orders for an in extremis mission, he was thoroughly shocked. And he was doubly astonished by the orders themselves. He and his men had trained for all manner of operations, but the first lieutenant had never executed anything like the mission the FSB general ordered him to undertake immediately. Less than 3 hours after the radio call came through, the first lieutenant and his 5 men had dressed in civilian clothes and were rolling duffel bags toward the helipad on the rear of the Admiral Chabanenko. While other sailors still on board watched with curiosity, the Spetsnaz unit climbed aboard the destroyer's own Kamov Ka-32 helicopter and lifted off into the evening sky over the port of San Juan del Sur. Their flight to the military airbase near Managua took only an hour, and there they were briefed by an FSB officer who had just arrived from Caracas. This briefing took another hour, and then the men were ordered to finish planning their mission and wait for a green light from Moscow. It was not until 4 a.m. local time when the green light came, and as soon as the first lieutenant knew the mission was a go, he and his team boarded a civilian Cessna caravan owned by a front company affiliated with Nicaraguan intelligence. They had already stowed all their gear on board, which was not easy, because each man had nearly 60 pounds of kit, so the cabin of the 10-seat plane was packed full of men and materiel. Still, the aircraft rose into the dark skies over sleeping Managua and banked to the south. While this was all going on, a second contingent of Russian nationals was on the water, having departed Maracaibo, Venezuela, in the late afternoon. These men were Russian intelligence agents, FSB, and they had received a phone call every bit as surprising as the Naval Spetsnaz First Lieutenant's afternoon radio communication. The FSB operatives in Maracaibo's orders were to secure a fast yacht and immediately sail across the choppy waters of the Caribbean Sea at best possible speed to the northwest. Their destination was the same as that of the commandos coming via air from the north, an archipelago in northern Panama called Bocas del Toro. Neither the GRU commandos nor the FSB operations officers knew that the FSB resident in Caracas had initiated the entire chain of events the day before. He had been told by friendly officials in Venezuela's General Counterintelligence Office that the federal police would begin rounding up men and women across the city. It was explained that an American traitor had given the Venezuelan embassy in Washington a list of 33 names of CIA agents in Venezuela in exchange for quick and safe passage out of the United States. Further, the GCIO executive relayed with excitement that the traitor soon intended to pass a second list of names, those of spies working against Venezuela in its embassies abroad. When the FSB man in Caracas contacted the Russian embassy in Moscow seeking confirmation of this wild story, he was told the FSB had just learned through a highly placed intelligence source in the U.S. government that the American FBI was looking for a National Security Council staff member named Ethan Ross, who had just fled the country, possibly after murdering his girlfriend and a pair of FBI agents who had been pursuing him. Also, rumors were circulating that he was on the run with a large digital cache of top-secret documents. At first, the FSB man in Caracas was skeptical. This sounded like some sort of American disinformation campaign. How could one man walk out of Washington with such a treasure trove of intelligence? But the GCIO officer showed Ethan Ross's list of Venezuelan spies to the FSB resident, and the Russian knew he was dealing with a real intelligence leak. Although the actual names of the agents weren't listed, they were given code names. The files described positions held, job titles, relationships with known personalities, and other recognizable aspects. So the agents' true identities were easy to discern. The Russian immediately recognized some of the positions as legitimate spies for America that the FSB had already identified but left in place. The resident was on the phone with Moscow within moments of getting this confirmation, and he was ordered by FSB leadership to pressure the Venezuelans to hand over the entire intelligence scrape as soon as the American was in Caracas. The resident himself suggested to the GCIO that they inject the American with SP-117, a Russian-developed truth serum drug that would, in theory anyway, ensure he gave up the password for his data. But the Venezuelans rebuked the Russians, claiming the American would be kept at a safe house in Panama until the arrests were complete and the time was right to bring him into the country. The FSB knew any American traitor with intelligence on his person of the nature this man allegedly had was a rapidly depreciating asset. The Americans would come after him hard and fast. They would find him in days, if not hours, and they would do what they needed to do to close the compromise. The FSB resident in Caracas conferred urgently over secure comms with Lubyanka, the FSB's headquarters in Moscow, and the decision was made to obtain the files via active measures. Executing the operation in Panama would be diplomatically preferable to doing it in Venezuela, and fooling the Venezuelans into thinking the Russian commandos sent on the mission were, in fact, Americans would be better still. The FSB resident thought it to be something of a miracle that this decision had been rendered in only 24 hours, but by the time the green light came for the Spetsnaz commandos in Managua, one thing was clear. The Russians were coming for Ethan Ross. They wanted the man and his files, and they planned on leaving no trace back to Moscow of their act. It had been a long and dismal day for Dominic Caruso. He'd avoided a cruel sunburn by staying under the edge of the rainforest canopy tucked inside a large fern, but he felt like he'd come damn close to heat exhaustion during the afternoon. He'd been bitten by ants and mosquitoes and crawled on by spiders and stared at by a sloth and a howler monkey. And shortly before dusk this evening, he'd had an experience that he knew would someday bring laughs from the rest of his team of operatives at the campus. A toucan had actually shat on his back from its perch in the oak above him. At the time, a two-man guard patrol had been nearby on the lawn, so Dominic just lay there and took the splatter. When he finally did get a chance to try and wipe it off, he saw he was covered in red, as if the bird had been eating a steady diet of wild berries. Dom would have laughed himself, had he been in the mood, but he wasn't, because through all today's effort and misery, he had yet to see any hint of Ethan Ross. Just before dusk, he did see one man who did not look like he belonged here at the mansion. A small, dark-complexioned individual who wore blue jeans in the 90-degree heat stood on the veranda for several minutes, talking on a mobile phone. Through the binoculars, Dom made out short hair and a very young-looking face, and he put the man at no older than 25. Dom pulled out a camera and took a few long-range shots, but the distance and the fading light made them all but worthless. After a lengthy phone call, the small man returned to the cool of the house and shut the door behind him. Dominic decided to change his position after 6 hours without any sighting of anyone other than the small man and the guard force. He left the majority of his gear in his hide, after pinpointing it with a GPS waypoint, and began moving laterally to the west toward the back of the property. He found a new temporary hide with a view of the swimming pool and the wraparound balcony at the rear of the house. When he was sure he was well hidden in deep tropical shrubs under the canopy of the rainforest, he pulled out his binoculars and scanned the windows. Unlike in the front, several of the curtains here were open, and he could see one man moving around, back and forth, on the second floor. Probably another guard, Dom determined, but he liked this position nonetheless, and decided to wait until dark when there would be a better view inside the lighted rooms and hallways of the property. Shortly before 10:30 in the evening, a breeze picked up and Dom smelled the approach of rain in the air. He decided he'd go back to his original hide site. It had better coverage, and he had a light poncho stored in his backpack he could use in the case of a serious downpour. But just as he put down his binoculars, he saw movement on the veranda. Quickly, he brought the glasses back to his eyes, and he saw a blond-haired man with a wine glass in his hand, standing against the railing and looking out over the swimming pool. He clutched what looked like a closed laptop computer under his arm. Tom scanned the man up and down. He couldn't really make out his face because he was standing out of the light. "Is that you, Ross?" he whispered to himself. It was impossible to be certain at 80 yards distance, even with the binoculars. He grabbed his camera and got a few inconclusive shots. Then he took more pictures when a female with long and curly black hair came through the French doors behind the blonde man. She carried a glass in one hand and a wine bottle in the other. Even at a distance, Dom could detect a wide smile on her face. She hugged the blonde-haired man awkwardly, because her hands were full, and the man just continued looking out over the back of the property like she wasn't there. Dom willed the blonde-haired man to step back into the light and face in his direction. Eventually, a large man in a cream-colored suit and with a brown mustache stepped out onto the veranda, and with his gesticulations, Dom could tell the man was beckoning the others back indoors. He focused the binoculars on the blonde, who finally did turn back to the French doors and step through them while talking to the big man in the cream-colored suit. As he did this, he walked into the light and faced the rainforest on the eastern side of the property. There, 80 yards away and invisible in the darkness beyond the lawn, Dominic Caruso lay under a fern with binoculars to his eyes. It was Ross. Softly, Dom said, "Nice to see you again, asshole. You think you're safe here? You might be safe from Albright. You might even be safe from me. But you aren't safe from Cheyetet 13. Ethan Ross disappeared behind the doors, and the light on the veranda snapped off. 35. Dominic made it back to his primary hide site just before midnight. He planned on calling David to let him know that he had positively identified Ross, but the rain clouds had completely obscured the moon and taken every bit of the natural light Dominic planned on using to traverse the jungle. Instead, he found the only way he could move was by keeping dangerously close to the lawn of the safe house. Even though the main house's lights didn't reach all the way to the rainforest on the edge, some ambient light made it this far. So Dom used the faint glow to find his way back toward the water and his hide. Now back in place and secure, he pulled out his sat phone, ready to call in Israeli Special Forces. But before he could make the call, the phone vibrated in his hand, and the low-light screen came alive with one word. Albright. This was interesting. Albright calling him. Dom answered in a voice just above a whisper. "Actually, Darren, this is kind of a bad time." The line hissed and crackled. Dom assumed the rain clouds were interfering with his signal. Albright's tone was sharp despite the distortion. "That is interesting. A couple of days ago you were bugging the shit out of me, and now you've suddenly found something better to do. Well, I won't keep you. I just thought I would let you know before you see it on the news." "Let me know what?" "Ethan Ross has stolen something in the neighborhood of 680,000 files out of Interlink TS. Sensitive, compartmented intelligence documents relating to CIA assets all over the world."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"He perpetrated a 150-gig intel scrape the day before yesterday. He used Eve Pang's credentials and logged on to a virtual private network, used some sort of a crawler that knew just where to go and what to look for. Forensics is still trying to reconstruct the breach so we can figure out exactly what he has, but it has been characterized to me as, and I'm quoting the text here, pretty much everything."
"Oh, God."
The two missing SSG guys turned up floating in the Potomac riddled with bullet holes. And a body that was shot up and torched in a Richmond hotel room the other day has been ID'd as another government IT guy, an ex-NSA employee named Philip McKell. This murder looks like it is somehow related. Dom just laid his head on the wet ground.
This keeps getting bigger, doesn't it?
You're damn right it does. And that's not the worst of it, Albright continued. Now it looks like Ross has run off to Venezuela. Dom lifted his head and cleared his throat softly.
Why do you say that?
Our CIA liaison has come to us at FBI to let us know that agency proxy assets in Caracas are getting snatched off the street. We're talking about somewhere around 24 just in the past 48 hours.
That's it, Dom thought. Payback
to the Venezuelans to get him out of the country. Before he could say anything, Albright continued. We checked some static cams we have set up to monitor the Venezuelan embassy on Thomas Jefferson here in D.C., and we see Ross walking into a side door the day before yesterday, right about the time the surveillance officers went missing. We figure he gave Venezuela intel from the scrape so they would help him get out of town. In the process, either Ross or the Venezuelans killed Philip McKell, Eve Pang, and two FBI surveillance officers. We've got to assume he's down in Caracas right now. Dominic's brain executed a multitude of calculations in the next few seconds. He tabulated all the pros and cons and decided to tell Albright almost everything he knew.
I've got some intel you can use.
I kinda hoped you might. Dom said,
Ross is in Panama, Bocas del Toro province, an island called Bastimentos.
If Albright expected that Caruso might have something for him, he certainly didn't expect this.
I beg your pardon? He is under the protection of Venezuelan intelligence officers. He's being held at a safe house about a half-hour boat ride from the airport.
After several seconds with nothing but the pops and cracks of the sat phone connection, Albright replied, If you don't tell me how you know this, I am going to make the very small and very reasonable leap that you are, in fact, working with Ethan Ross.
You know that's asinine.
Probably so. But I'm going to fuck with you anyhow. You are impeding my investigation.
Damn it, Albright. I just told you where your suspect is hiding. That is exactly the opposite of impeding your investigation.
Dom took a calming breath, did his best to look at it through Albright's eyes.
I know, because the Israelis told me.
What Israelis?
The guys who want Ross for his role in Arik Yaqobi's death.
Any chance I could sit down with these Israelis and have a little friendly chat?
I doubt it. Anyway, they have me at the tip of the spear right now. I know more than they do.
How is that?
I've got eyes on the safe house as we speak.
Albright's tone turned even darker and more accusatory.
You are in Panama?
Yep.
You are in pretty fucking deep, aren't you, Caruso?
Hey, man. No law against a private citizen taking a trip down to sunny Central America.
As he said it, the rain began to fall again.
Don't bullshit me. You're down there with your spook friends with a plan to kill Ross.
I keep telling you, no spook friends. I am down here with a hot blonde who could kick both our asses, but she's no spook.
Dom cracked a half smile, wiping water from his eyes as he did so.
She's just a stewardess.
Albright obviously didn't know what to make of this comment, but he did not for a moment think it was true. He was fixated on the fact Caruso might be on a kill mission.
Listen to me very, very carefully. Whatever you and your friends have planned for Ross, this is a game changer. Ethan Ross very likely has the scrape with him right this minute. You kill him, and we might lose access to it. It's out there in the wind somewhere, and we have to get it back.
Dom said,
He's got a laptop with him. I saw it.
That might be it, then. If not that, it could be on a portable hard drive.
How do you know he hasn't already handed it off to someone?
We don't know. But this last-minute scrape wasn't designed to go unnoticed. It has all the markings of someone trying to give himself a bargaining position. To steal data because he knew we were onto him, so he'd have something to barter with. We think he'll keep it with him at all times. He knows computers and has the expertise to encrypt the files to where they're worthless to anyone else without his password.
Dom wanted to kill the son of a bitch in that house lit up across the dark lawn, or at least help the Israelis do it. But he knew now that killing Ross without getting the scrape back would endanger the lives of American assets all over the world.
Fuck.
Things just got complicated.
He understood the ramifications of that type of intelligence product loose in the wind. He'd play by Albright's rules.
Okay. I'll hang tight where I am and help you guys get it back. I'll text you the coordinates as soon as we're off the phone. How long till you're down here?
I'll get a fly team from HRT together and get the paperwork in motion. It's 4+ hours in the air direct with fixed wing to Panama City. We'll need to meet up with helos that can take us to his actual location. It might be after dawn before we get there.
I'll keep an eye out till then,
Dom said. Not alone you won't. We'll get you some support. We're friendly with the Panamanian public forces. I can make a call and...
Look, it's your show, but I wouldn't do that.
And why not?
I've seen Panamanian police patrol boats cruising up and down the waterway by this safe house all day long. I think it's possible the local cops are getting paid by Venezuelans to keep an eye out.
Albright understood the quandary.
Shit.
And even if we talk to the federal cops, there's no way to be sure they won't let the wrong thing slip to the local cops. And Ross might well disappear again.
Bingo, said Dom. Maybe you guys should just haul ass down here and raid this place. I haven't seen more than a half dozen guards outside. I assume there are at least that number inside, but if you come in with enough shock and awe first thing tomorrow when everyone is half asleep, you can wrap up Ethan Ross and his scrape.
Albright said, It would make me feel better if you went ahead and admitted you did have some other spook friends with you.
There are no other guys, Albright.
The FBI man sighed. I'll send special agents from the FBI office in Panama City your way. It's just a couple of guys who investigate bank fraud, but I want bureau control of your operation. Dom said,
I have no idea what kind of time we have. The Venezuelans might move him any minute.
It's important that you and your guys keep eyes on him and do not try to take him yourselves.
Dom sighed. He was tired of repeating himself that he wasn't down here with the CIA.
He said,
Okay, I'll pass the word down to the rest of my brigade to stand fast.
Smartass, Albright mumbled before hanging up. Dom's phone rang moments later. He looked down and recognized David's number. The D.C.-based Mossad officer would be calling for an update, hoping his American Confederate had made a positive ID of the target so he could send down a team of shooters on a vengeance mission. The Mossad's interests were clear and unchanged. They wanted Ethan Ross's head on a pike. But Dominic's mission had changed with the call from Albright. He didn't even see how he could tell David, an agent of a foreign nation, about the intelligence scrape. Israel was an ally of the United States, so maybe the CIA would notify them at some point. But Caruso knew it sure as hell wasn't his call to make. He did not answer his phone. David would be pissed, but right now there was nothing Dom could do about that. He shifted position in his hide and moved the fern a little in the process. He reached up to stop the stems and leaves from moving, and as he did, he heard a noise nearby. Dom froze, but after 20 seconds of holding his breath, he saw the source of the noise in the dark. A pair of howler monkeys moved along the lawn in front of him, not 40 feet away. Either they didn't see him, or they didn't care that a human being was lying in the brush at the edge of the trees.
Once he relaxed his nerves with a few sips of water from his canteen, he realized it was time to check in with Sherman. Even though it was midnight, she answered on the first ring. Dom was continually impressed with her abilities as a supporting agent. He told her about seeing Ross and about getting the call from Albright that meant this tropical island would soon be running with hyped-up and pissed-off American federal law enforcement officers. Adara said, "You want me to start heading that way?"
"No. I'm going to keep eyes on the compound all night."
"It's midnight now. There are still a few boats moving between the islands. If I don't get you now, you run the risk of getting stuck there. If you call me for an extraction at 3 a.m. or some other time in the middle of the night, I'll be the only boat on the water. The Venezuelans will hear me coming for miles, or the Panamanian police will stop me. A blonde tourist cruising alone in the middle of the night is going to draw some attention that neither of us wants." "I understand. HRT will be here in the morning, and I need to give them real-time intelligence on the area. I'm on my own till the feds get here. Then I'll have you come and pick me up."
"Roger that," said Adara, and Dom hung up. He lay there surrounded by the flora and fauna of Central America, hoping like hell nothing larger than a mosquito would dine on him this evening, while he kept tabs on the American trader, tucked in and comfortable in the big house across the lawn.
36. It was still dark at 6 a.m., although the rain clouds had moved on and faint moonlight filtered down to Bustamento's Island. Dom rubbed his eyes, slowly realizing he had fallen asleep for a few minutes, though it hadn't been long enough to provide him any real comfort. His position happened to be right in the habitat of a group of small, colorful frogs, and throughout the night the hopping creatures in the ferns by his face or on the ground in front of his backpack startled him and ensured he'd stayed awake the vast majority of the time. He lifted his binos off the ground next to him, wiped condensation off all four lenses with a rag, and then brought them up to his eyes to scan the area. He saw a pair of guards on the far side of the property. Their flashlight beams made them obvious even at a distance. There was no movement inside the building other than a couple patrolling guards he could see through the windows just inside the main door at ground level. An aircraft passed high above, and Dom realized it had been the faint engine hum that had roused him. Dom couldn't see the plane with the thick canopy directly overhead, but he could hear the drone of a single-engine turboprop and guessed it was probably about 5,000 feet above ground. He kept scanning the house. His eyes were impossibly tired, but he did his best to focus. As he scanned, he was surprised by the sudden crack of a tree branch on his left. It wasn't close to his position, but it was loud enough to stick out among the other sounds. Chirping frogs fell silent with the noise. A moment later, a second breaking tree branch followed, and then a quick succession of rustling leaves and more cracks of breaking limbs came from another part of the jungle, also on his left. Dom pulled the M9 pistol from his hip, and then he tucked himself lower under the fern, unsure what was happening 30 or 40 yards off his left shoulder. Before he could ponder the question, a figure appeared on the lawn in front of him, and above the figure, the silhouette of a deforming parachute. The dark canopy covered the man, and Dom watched as another figure dropped from the sky not 20 yards away from the first man, just outside of the lights of the house. Dom almost launched to his feet in surprise. Now another crash in the trees, this time to his right. From the noise, Dom concluded another jumper had landed short of his intended landing zone and was now hanging from one of the oaks or yellow trees here in the rainforest. Dogs began barking in the kennel on the far side of the house now, and then two more figures landed on the darkened lawn, and they collected their chutes in their arms and then followed the others back into the trees. That made a total of 6 men that Dom had seen or heard falling from the sky, all in the space of no more than 10 seconds. They had all pulled back into the edge of the rainforest, and were now likely stowing their chutes and preparing their gear somewhere very close to his position.
Holy shit,
Dom thought. Could it be the FBI hostage rescue team? Albright hadn't said a damn thing about an airborne mission on the compound, but Dom couldn't rule it out. He'd love to check with Darren right now, but he wasn't about to make a phone call with a crew of unknowns around him. Even if they were FBI and aware he was here and providing overwatch on the property, Dom knew announcing his presence in the middle of a bunch of itchy trigger fingers wouldn't end well for him. No way. Dom decided he would lie right here and watch. Surely, he told himself, this had to be the FBI. Who the hell else could it be? Mossad? No. David had called Dom a half dozen times in the past few hours, and Dom had not called back yet. He didn't think it likely Mossad would launch its own mission against this location without any reconnaissance from the man they knew they had on the ground. A pair of flashlight beams emanating from the driveway illuminated the lawn. This would be the two-man guard team Dom had seen patrolling the perimeter all night long. From the casual sway of the beams, the Venezuelans didn't seem to be too worried about the dogs alerting to something in the jungle, but they were coming this way nonetheless. Dom assumed the men had heard noises, but considering the prevalence of monkeys, sloths, toucans, and other wildlife large enough to rustle the trees, the guards would be dulled into complacency, no matter what official threat level their leadership had imposed for the safe house. Dom caught glimpses of the approaching men at first, due to the flashlight beams in his face, but when they passed his position, moving closer to the water, the beams tracked away, and Dom could clearly make out the men behind the lights. The two Venezuelans had taken their G3 rifles off their shoulders, and they held them one-handed, with the lights in the other. Again, to Dominic, these guys didn't look like they were ready for a fight. But those six men in the trees would be ready, Dom had no doubt. And as soon as the two guards passed, Dom saw a second pair of dark figures moving behind them. He could discern no weapons in their hands, but they closed on the armed guards quickly and quietly, and as one they took them by the necks from the rear, spun them, disarmed them, and silenced them with a series of blindingly fast strikes to the torso and face. The two guards crumpled into a single heap on the dark lawn, and Dom knew from the damage inflicted on vital parts of their body they were dead. The mysterious killers then dragged the men and their weapons back into the trees to the right of Dom's hide. Dom had seen the entire fight from 20 yards away, and even though not a word had been spoken, even though Dom could not see the faces of the men who'd just parachuted onto the island, and even though the men wore no insignia or recognizable uniforms, Dom knew who they were, because he knew the fighting style. The two men had employed an efficient and lethal flowing attack against the guards that was not dissimilar to Krav Maga, but it was distinct enough for Dom to recognize it. It was Sistema, and it was a style developed in Russia and used by Russian special mission units. Things around here just got even more complicated, because Spetsnaz had dropped from the sky. A minute later, Dom saw the six silhouettes moving across the lawn to the west, closer to the trucks and the swimming pool. He made out the distinctive shape of the Heckler & Koch MP7 personal defense weapon in each man's hand, and the men, of course, moved like a paramilitary force, covering and advancing in pairs. But they weren't heading directly to the colonial mansion just yet. It looked to Dom as if they would not attack the house immediately. Instead, they disappeared up the driveway. Dom thought they were going to do a little recon themselves to get a feel for the situation inside by finding cover near the pool house and watching the building from there. He tried to call Albright, but got no answer. Dom assumed he was on the aircraft heading down and couldn't get a signal at the moment. And even if the FBI agents from Panama City were already here in the area, that wouldn't do him much good, since they were financial crimes experts and not paramilitary trained like HRT, and they would probably be in Bocas Town, where even if they could secure a boat, it would still take them a half hour to get here. Whatever was about to happen would be over in much less than a half hour. Dom recognized he was on his own. Well, he thought, not exactly. He called Adara. She answered quickly.
It's only been an hour since last check-in. Is something wrong? It's more than wrong. It's all about to turn into a battle zone over here.
I'm moving to the boat. Keep talking. Dom said,
don't head this way yet. Just be ready by the boat if I need you.
But
no buts. Stay right there till I call for you.
What's going on?
Dom told her about the Russian Spetsnaz troops and their killing of the guards. He explained he thought they'd probably move toward the house soon, and when they did, they would take Ethan Ross and his intelligence scrape with hundreds of thousands of documents detailing the thousands of paid agents for U.S. intelligence around the world.
Yeah, Adara agreed. The Russians would love to get their hands on that. And killing a few Venezuelans to pull off an intelligence coup of that magnitude would be no big deal to them at all.
Twice more, Dom had to tell Adara to stand fast at the dockside hotel. She was champing at the bit to come in support of him, but Dom didn't even know what he was going to do yet. The last thing he wanted was to have to watch over her. Dom strained through his binos for any glimpse of the dark figures near the pool house around the side of the house, but he saw nothing but blackness. He figured the next time he would be aware of the Russians' presence was when he saw the flashes of the MP7s in the windows of the colonial mansion. He saw it as almost a fait accompli that these half-dozen Russian commandos would take Ross. They would have some avenue of escape already set up. Dom assumed there was a boat to get them off the island, or maybe even a helo inbound to the property. They would all be long gone from the scene before Albright and his HRT arrived on site. He slammed his fist into the ground, his body desperate to expel some of the frustration building up as he lay there, thinking about losing the man responsible for the Yacobi's deaths to a nation that would use him and his intelligence to ruin the CIA.
No, he said softly. He could not let this happen.
Dom decided he knew only one thing for sure. Ethan Ross, in the hands of the Venezuelans, was not good. But it was a whole lot less bad than Ethan Ross in the hands of the Russians. No question that more damage could be done to America by Moscow's spies. Dom knew he couldn't stop the Russians. But he could give the Venezuelans a heads up. He would have to reveal himself and then suffer the consequences, which likely meant taking fire from the Russians and the Venezuelans, but he decided he would much rather have Ross and his scrape in the Venezuelans' hands than the Russians' hands. He called Adara back, and as soon as the call was connected, he said,
"Remember when I told you I would keep you out of danger?"
"Is this the part where you tell me you were lying?"
"Of course not. This is the part where I tell you I was mistaken."
"I'll forgive you. If you forgive me for ignoring your instructions, I'm on the water and on the way to you already."
"Good. Stay on the boat. I'll come to you."
He thought for a moment. What if he could actually get his hands on Ross? It sounded implausible, but he expected an incredible amount of chaos in that house in the next few minutes, and the prospect of taking advantage of the confusion and somehow taking control of Ross and his scrape seemed like it might be worth the risk. He said,
"If I get really lucky, I'll have a guest with me."
"Ross?
You're actually going after Ross?" "I can dream, can't I?"
Dom hung up, then climbed to his knees and began working on a plan, all the while still utterly bewildered by the fact he was about to go into battle partially on the side of an American traitor and the enemy intelligence agency that spirited him out of the United States.
"Crazy," he said softly, and then he broke into a low sprint across the dark lawn.
37. As Dom moved low and fast across the property, the barking of the dogs on the far side of the house seemed to grow louder, even though there was no way they could see him in their kennels. Two men standing on the veranda ringing the second floor shined flashlights all around the lawn facing the inlet and the dock, but Dom moved laterally to avoid them, and he ran on to the side of the house near the driveway. More men shined their lights at the back of the property. Dom could see the beams raking across the pool area and the vehicles, and as he ran, he wondered if the Russian paramilitaries hiding somewhere back there might find themselves spotlighted by the guards on the veranda before attacking the building. Dom made it to the side of the big colonial house. He pressed his body flush with the cool wall, and then began moving along the wall through thick, flowering hedges. He came to a darkened window, chanced to look inside, and saw nothing but black on his first glance. He stood to the side of the window, waited a moment, then looked again. It took a few seconds for his eyes to pick up any features inside, but soon he realized the room was some sort of a storage area. Banquet tables were stacked high against the far wall, sporting equipment, small soccer goals, a croquet set, and several balls in net bags hung from hooks on the wall. The door to the room was closed. He tried the window but found it securely locked. He thought about breaking one of the panes near the lock, but just as he prepared to use the butt of the Beretta to do this, he stopped, took his flashlight, and flicked it quickly on the little room, his eyes locked on the ceiling near the window. Yep, as he expected, a glass break sensor jutted an inch from the ceiling. If he smashed the window pane, sirens would blare all over the property. As he turned away to look for another point of entry, a sudden crackle of gunfire echoed off the trees of the rainforest and all over the lawn. It had come from the rear of the property near the pool, and Dom knew this meant the Venezuelans and the Russians were engaged in a firefight. Alarms started blaring throughout the house. Dom took advantage of this by turning back to the window pane and smashing it with the grip of his pistol. In seconds, he had the lock open and the window lifted high enough for him to enter. Ethan Ross woke from an alcohol-aided sleep and leapt to his feet with the loud crackling sounds. He thought it might have been gunfire, but he'd never been around actual shooting, and he'd expected it to sound like it did on television. He stuck his head out the door of his bedroom, on guard but more curious than afraid, but almost instantly he panicked when the sirens began blaring. A guard stood close to his door, but the man had turned away to look over the mezzanine down at the main room of the mansion. "What's going on?" Ethan shouted, but the man did not respond. He knew just enough Spanish to ask, "¿Qué pasa?" "No sé," the man shouted back. He had his big black gun against his shoulder and he waved it around at the first floor below. Just then Mohammed came running around the corner in his stocking feet. He made a beeline straight to Ross, passing Gianna Bertoli with utter indifference as she came out of a room with a robe held around her shoulders. Ethan noticed Mohammed had a mobile phone in one hand and his computer in the other. He'd left his shoes, but he hadn't left his computer or his phone. Mohammed shouted, "The Americans are here! We have to leave!" Ethan turned and ran back into his room. He tried to shut the door, but Mohammed was right on his heels and followed him in. "Get the drive. Do you have the drive?" Ethan looked toward his laptop, and Mohammed caught the look. "It's on the computer?" Ethan didn't answer. The drive was still attached with moleskin to his hip, but he snatched the laptop off the table, threw it into his backpack, and slung it over his back. When they raced back out onto the mezzanine, Ethan saw the Venezuelan intelligence chief Leo had arrived with two more of his men, making a total of four armed Venezuelans. Leo wore a sweatshirt and cotton pants, but he carried a machine pistol in one hand and a walkie-talkie in the other.
"Quickly, come with me. I have a man in a truck waiting for us by the kennels. The Americans will expect us to try for the expeditions on the other side of the house. We must hurry."
Mohammed asked, "How many attackers?"
"I don't know," shouted Leo,
but he led the way with his weapon out in front of him. The procession moved down the rear stairwell and then out into a long gallery that ran the length of the back of the house. Leo turned to the left, and the others began following, but as they passed an archway that led to the large main room of the home, automatic gunfire erupted from the dark. One of the Venezuelan guards spun dead to the wooden gallery floor, and Leo and the other three fired back into the room as they ran past the archway and out of the line of fire. Mohammed and Gianna were ahead of Ethan, so they made it across the kill zone. But Ethan had hesitated, and now he found himself alone between the stairs and the archway, afraid to move forward and join the others. As Mohammed shouted at him, urging him to catch up, Ethan instead turned away and began running in the opposite direction down the gallery, past the stairs and toward the kitchen. Behind him at the archway, the gunfire increased. He rounded the corner into the kitchen now. A row of dim lights ran under the shelves over the counter, giving the room a glow, and with this light, Ethan could see a figure standing in the middle of the room, not 20 feet in front of him. He was a white man in wet brown clothing and a scruffy beard. His sleeves were rolled up and his forearms were covered in mud. He held a black pistol in his hand, and he pointed it straight at Ethan. Ethan stopped, raised his hands quickly. "You got it with you?" The man spoke English. Ethan was too terrified to answer. Behind him, on the far side of the gallery, multiple automatic weapons barked back and forth at one another. "You got the scrape?"
I...
The man pulled the hammer back on his pistol. "I'm not asking again."
"I've got it."
"You're coming with me."
Who are... No!
The man with the gun raised the weapon suddenly and fired. Ethan screamed, dropped to the ground, his hands still above his head. Behind him, a GIO officer had run into the room with a G3 rifle shouldered, but the American in the brown shirt shot him dead as he entered. A second Venezuelan entered the kitchen, his rifle firing as he came through the door. Ethan rolled onto his side in the fetal position, screaming at the top of his lungs, but he kept his eyes open, and he saw the American in the brown shirt run to his left, chased across the kitchen by flashing sparks and bullet holes that tore into the stove and refrigerator and tiled backsplash over the oven. The American dove through the air, his pistol still in his hand, and he executed a complete forward roll on the floor to get through the doorway to the dining room.
"Ethan!"
The scream came from behind, and Ross looked back to see Mohammed crouched low in the doorway next to the Venezuelan with the rifle. Mohammed's hand was out, beckoning Ethan to crawl out of the kitchen.
"Come on!"
The American in the brown shirt ducked his head back around from the dining room. The Venezuelan shot at him, but the American returned fire with the pistol, firing several rounds. Then he retreated again around the corner. Ethan looked at the Venezuelan. He'd been shot in the left shin, just below the knee, and now he lay on the ground, grabbing at his leg, with the rifle on the floor next to him. Mohammed dove on the rifle, lifted it up toward the dining room entrance, and fired several rounds. Even with all the chaos, Ethan was surprised the small Lebanese computer geek knew how to shoot a gun. Mohammed shouted,
"Ethan! Come!"
Ethan climbed to his hands and knees and crawled out of the dim kitchen. He found his feet and started running through the main room of the house, but Mohammed caught up with him from behind.
"No, not that way. You are going toward the other Americans."
On cue, more gunfire snapped at the back of the house. Glass shattered, and men shouted.
"Run!"
Mohammed commanded, and Ethan found himself following the Lebanese man's instructions. Together they ran through the main room of the house, which had been the center of the battle just a minute earlier. Now, however, much of the gunfire seemed to be upstairs. As Ethan ran, he tripped over the body of a dead man, fell to the floor, and lay there exhausted and terrorized.
"Get up!"
Mohammed shouted, and he pulled Ethan to his feet, then pushed him forward. They found a broken window in a library on the ground floor near the back of the house, and Mohammed used the barrel of the rifle to push out enough glass to climb through. Ethan followed. Both men found themselves outside in a hedge near the pool that rimmed the building, and Mohammed scanned all around for any movement. Just then Leo and Gianna rushed out the French doors that led to the pool area. Leo had been shot, Blood ran from his shoulder down the length of his body, and even in the dim decorative lighting around the pool deck, Ethan could see the man's face had gone white. He staggered past his guests, holding a walkie-talkie in his hands and calling out to members of his